You're listening to an ESA podcast brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. ESA, promoting the science of ecology.
I'm Christine Buckley, and this is Field Talk, a podcast produced by the Ecological Society of America. In Field Talk, we learn about the work of authors whose papers have been published in the Society's journals, Ecology, Ecological Applications, and Ecological Monographs. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Andrew Altieri, a postdoctoral researcher at Brown University. His research focuses on marine systems off the coast of Rhode Island, where low levels of oxygen have become increasingly common. In the October issue of Ecology, he shows that these hypoxic conditions can have some surprising consequences for marine invertebrates. Dr. Altieri, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So what are the main questions that you're trying to address with your work along this marine hypoxic gradient?
The general question that guides my research is how global change and human impacts in particular are affecting coastal ecosystems and the services that they provide to human societies. And so with this aspect of my research, what I've been investigating is how low oxygen areas, which are popularly known as dead zones, are affecting life in these coastal estuaries and my study system of Narragansett Bay in particular. My earlier research has revealed that hypoxia has severely negative consequences for some of the species that live in the system, in particular the blue mussels, which is an edible species that's commonly grown in aquaculture around the world. In my more recent research, I've found that hypoxia appears to be benefiting another species that lives in the same system that's able to tolerate the low oxygen events. And so what my research has been examining is what species might be benefiting, which species might be detrimentally affected by low oxygen, and what are the consequences for the greater ecosystem.
So what does it mean for the ecosystem as a whole in the way that it functions that some might benefit and some might not?
The most immediate response or change that's obvious in the system is a change in which species are found in various parts of the estuary and their relative abundance as well. And so what's immediately apparent, if you get in the water and take a look around at what's living on and in the muddy or sandy bottom of an estuary such as this, is that the players or the species that are there are changing in their abundance and in their diversity. That in turn has consequences for the ecosystem and its functions. I mean, in this case, some of the key functions and ecosystem services, those functions with human value, are filtration of the water column. Bivalves such as clams and mussels filter the water and can help remove the negative effects of pollution. And another service that these species provide in an estuary like this is food for humans, or the basis for a commercial fishery. And so hypoxia has a potential to affect the filtration services of those animals and the fishery services of those animals by dictating where and in what abundance those species are found.
So if you have a lot of the same bivalve, is that worse than having a diversity if you have the same abundance?
I think the short answer is that it's not clear. And initially it would seem that there's just sort of an equal trade, and that one species goes down, another species come up. And if those species are truly redundant, then it would seem that there's no real negative consequence of a hypoxia or a dead zone. But what becomes clearer when you look at changes that have happened in estuaries such as Narragansett Bay over decades or centuries is that the loss of some species can be somewhat permanent. That is, that they're not going to necessarily rebound within a year or two if the bad conditions just go away. And so in this instance, sure, one species seems to have increased in abundance, other species are declining, but what that means is that the system is left overall more vulnerable, because if that remaining species, in this case it's the quahog clam, Mercenaria mercenaria, it's also known as the hardshell clam, you know, we're largely dependent on that species to maintain the fisheries and the filtration services in the low oxygen areas. If that species is lost because of either worsening a low oxygen conditions or because of disease or some other factor, then there's really no other species to turn to in this case. The quahog clam lives buried in the mud, whereas some of the other bivalves that used to be more common in the system, such as oysters and mussels, live in clusters on top of the mud or sand. And therefore, those oysters and mussels are able to create a living reef that is a habitat for other animals, such as worms and crabs and small fish and snails. And the quahog clam just doesn't do that because of its habitat where it lives within the mud.
Do we know what the causes are for these dead zones?
Yeah, in general, dead zones in these coastal areas and in estuaries in particular are caused by nutrient pollution. So that can be from urban runoff, it can be from agricultural runoff, from either animal waste or excess fertilizer on fields. It can also be from sewage that isn't treated properly. All those inputs increase the amount of nutrients in the water, which essentially fertilize the plankton and algae that live in those estuaries. And when that algae and the microscopic phytoplankton in particular die and sink to the bottom, oxygen is consumed through their decomposition. And if it's not replaced, then you end up with dead zones on the bottom of these estuaries.
Once an area becomes dead because of lots of nutrients, is it possible to restore it? Is there anything we can do?
Yeah, there is indications. There's been a number of studies that have been conducted around the world that have monitored the succession or the aggression of the biological community in these dead zones when the supply of nutrients has been reduced or cut off, where that's been managed. And it's happened in a few times in a few places. And it looks like there is recovery along a somewhat predictable trajectory where there's sort of like weedy species that have high dispersal potential and high fecundity or reproductive output will initially colonize an area. And over time, the community becomes more developed with more species, bigger individuals, and some recovery of those ecological functions and services I indicated before. And that can happen over the course of years or decades. But one thing that should be noted is that some species can be lost from an area entirely or nearly entirely. So that's known as functional extinction, which basically means a species might as well not be there at all because it's in such low abundance and barely hanging on by its fingertips, metaphorically speaking. In that case, if a species isn't there to recolonize those dead areas, then you aren't going to get recovery back to sort of the initial or pristine conditions. You will get some recovery, at least superficially, of some of the functions and some of the components of the ecosystem, but you aren't necessarily going and get a return to pre-human impact.
So what got you started studying this marine system?
My interest in marine systems in general started when I was much younger, scuba diving in the kelp forests of California with my father. And those interests were put into motion when I was an undergraduate at UC Santa Cruz, working in California and also in the Caribbean and in the Sea of Cortez with graduate students and faculty. And then I started my graduate studies at Brown. And Narragansett Bay provided a clear opportunity to look at human impacts in a coastal ecosystem because Providence, which is the capital city and large city here in Rhode Island, sits right at the top of that estuary, and there's dense human populations and settlements all along the coastline of the bay. And the bay is very important to the cultural and sort of economic identity of the state as well. It is the ocean state. And so you clearly have the potential for intense human impacts on the bay with this dense population living right on the coastline. But then there's also sort of demand for having a healthy or relatively healthy ecosystem and the services that such a healthy estuarine ecosystem can provide to those humans. By getting in the water, scuba diving, and surveying and conducting experiments with these populations of animals living on the bay's bottom, I was able to start to understand some of the mechanisms that could tip the balance between human impacts and the services that the estuary in turn provides to humans, that can tip that balance in one way or another.
I would like to ask you what the most exciting thing is about your work, but maybe you've already answered that by saying that you get to go scuba diving in kelp forests and off the coast.
I think day to day, working outside and underwater certainly has its thrills. There's always unexpected encounters with marine life, you know, getting stung by jellyfish or having horseshoe crabs, you know, run across your fingers or bump into your leg while working on the bottom. And ultimately, you know, what's exciting about this work is producing relevant knowledge and understanding that I hope will guide the action in citizens and policy that can be enacted by government leaders and enforced by managers. And ultimately, you know, all of that is very satisfying and strong motivation for doing the work that I do.
Where do you see this work going in the next 5 or 10 years.
From a purely ecological standpoint, it's an open question where the net benefits may lie in these dead zones. A species like quahog, which is able to persist in those dead zones where there may be higher nutrient and plant productivity, we call this sort of bottom-up forcing, that has the potential to increase the output of those species in those areas. So there's the ability to tolerate stress has some costs, but there might be some benefits associated with those higher nutrient inputs. I think the degree to which those positive and negative consequences play out for a species like the quahog has yet to be determined. I think moving beyond just a strict ecological study, there's also just a question of the exact social and economic ramifications of dead zones. But, you know, these positive impacts of dead zones, I think, have a very real potential for showing up as in the bottom line or the dollar figures of fisheries. And ultimately, it would be nice to get involved to a degree in making sure that findings from research such as mine ends up in the hands of people that can direct change in the activity of humans and the impacts that they're having.
And lots more scuba diving, I imagine.
Yeah, plenty of that. Always trying to find a way to make sure that I spend a lot of time in the field seeing firsthand what the driving mechanisms are in these ecosystems. I think it's easy as a scientist moves along in their academic development for science to become more and more of an office job. And my interest in spending time outside and working directly in these ecosystems with the plants and animals that are so important to the ecosystems, you know, that was my initial motivation to get involved with science. And that will always be an important part of my activities.
That was Andrew Altieri, a postdoctoral fellow at Brown University. I'm Christine Buckley. Thanks for listening to Field Talk.
This podcast has been brought to you by the Ecological Society of America. Music was provided by Dr. Nicholas Gattelli. For a link to Dr. Gattelli's homepage, more information about ESA, or additional podcasts, please visit www.esa.org. Thanks for listening.